this is like a totally white male dominated field. So every time I show up, the first thing is it's always a trivia question because people can't figure out like why someone that looks like me is like standing on stage. They're like, why is she here? What the fuck is she? The first thing is all the guys are like, is she Chinese? Is she Thai? Is she Vietnamese? Is she like a piano teacher? That's the thing. You know, it's like I look like a piano teacher, so racial profiling is like totally correct. They're like, yeah, sure. She's always like, she must be really good at math, right? Space in a comic show ever. Like, I'm just like wondering, like, are you guys all having your periods at the same time?
Hello and welcome to Carnival Personnel Sideshow. I'm Jacques.
This is Biff.
Joe.
So over the last year and a half of falling down the rabbit hole of doing stand-up, I've met some great comics. We've had so many great comics on the show. So many different voices that I'm hearing. But now and then, like, yeah, let's face it. Most of the comics out there that I'm doing this are younger versions of me, late 20s, white guys, you know, dudes in this area. But now and then, it's nice when you hear different voices. And it's also nice when you have come across somebody who is just different, and their comedy is different, and it's a lot of right turns, and it's not what you're expecting. And it was several months ago, I can't remember if it was One Broadway in Lawrence or in Worcester, but I ran across this comic who instantly was just different, incredibly funny, and a bonus, not another middle-aged white guy like me. And so I said, hey, can you jump on our podcast? And she said, yes, love to, but here's my resume of these amazing head-spinning things that I have coming up, plus a trip to, you know, the homeland. But when I get back, I'd love to do it. And so we are now at that point. So I would like to have a huge, warm Carnival Personnel welcome to my comedian friend, Sarah. If we need he.
No.
Chukaki. No. I was trying to do my French. I was trying to do my French for the middle name. I fucked it up.
Biff, he fucked up two of the three names. That was great.
Anthony. Anthony.
Anthony.
Wow. Anthony Takagi, right?
Ah, Yamazaki-san. So great to see you. Jack, nice thank you so much for the warm welcome. And Joe, thanks. Thank you guys for having me on your show. I have no idea what this is about.
Yeah, neither we.
I assumed that the person of your stature was here under court order. Because it's Saturday morning.
Oh man. So I wasn't even sure you were going to introduce me as a comedian, but was it the Blackstone Worcester?
Blackstone.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that the one? Okay, yeah. Cuz I saw you there. Yeah, and I think that's the one where I think according to Thomas, I was one of the few people who were able to make the two girls at the bar laugh, because apparently I had a kind of a feminine joke that I'm not going to try to re-perform, but I do you remember what I did?
Oh yeah, no, I definitely did. And that is kind of one of those, you know, for Biff and Joe, it's almost like one of those ambush mics where it's, it's a regular restaurant and bar. Yeah. And 90% of the people there who aren't comics have no idea that a comedy show is about to happen.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And but those are tough crowds. But no, you were fantastic. And we chatted. And so I would love to talk about your comedy and all that stuff. But you were just getting ready to go on a trip. And you had mentioned that you hadn't taken a trip to this destination in a while, and you were very excited about it. So where did you go on that trip?
Oh, wait, are you talking about Japan or New York?
Yes. Yeah, you were going to Japan.
Right. I went to see Biff's great grandmother's
wow.
uncle's nephew's niece.
Yeah.
And they said they you haven't written back in a long time.
That's because I'm illiterate. Yeah, because I'm illiterate in Japanese now, so I can't. You know, I lost that talent a long time ago.
And they're saving a very individual, specialized Japanese trash can for you.
Oh, good.
So, Sarah, I did go through your Instagram this morning, not to be a creep, but just to see what was.
This is one time when you're not a creep.
Yeah, I was again. I was under orders to do so, but I noticed that one of your pictures was you at an airport in the U.S. I think Logan, hugging a large, humongous trash can in one of the terminals, and your caption underneath basically said like, "Yeah, I just came back from Japan where they have literally zero trash cans."
Right.
And that was something when Biff, he regaled us with his trip to Japan not too long ago. He failed to mention that little tidbit. So I was like, Biff, this is the first topic of conversation we're having with Sarah.
It's kind of, it's funny because it used to not be like that, but I think maybe in the last 10 years.
When were you there last
year? I was there in November, just before Thanksgiving.
Like just last year?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, literally just there. So it wouldn't... Yeah.
What part of Japan? Tokyo or?
So Tokyo, yeah. So this time was a different. Normally, I just go to Tokyo. I hang around with my. So usually, all I do is go shopping, go hang around places, and then get drunk with my friends. That's my usual Tokyo trip. But this time around, I had my son. So yeah.
Well, guys, I'm so sorry to say, being a prankster and a comedian, all of a sudden this is an audio show, right?
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Holy cow. Biff, are you saying you speak Japanese?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. Wow, we could just hijack the whole
thing. But this is true.
Please do.
and then like, even the narrower.
Funny?
And then Jacques can do the audio subtitle, like the English translation.
How about you'll just have to guess whatever we're saying?
Okay,
Jack, you can just translate what we just said.
Oh, okay. Ready. Okay. So Biff was saying that you must be thrilled to get to do stand up with somebody incredibly magnificent hair like Jacques. And then what, Infinity said was, oh my goodness, the best hair I've seen in an open. And then Joe said with his eye roll, nobody's saying that at all, Jack. You're embarrassing yourself. So please stop.
That was a review of the latest Godzilla movie. Sorry. Sorry. You're both wrong.
No, actually, Jack, I remember one of your jokes that I really loved. I think one of the jokes that I remember that you did that was just so fabulous was you, because I do a lot of, I'm constantly trying the latest diet, the latest trying to lose the extra 10, 15 pounds. And then you had a joke about, well, your wife and you went on a diet, but you kind of got in a disagreement because you interpreted the cheat day as a little bit of in a wider range. That was pretty funny. I remember that was one of your jokes.
It's one of my wife's favorite jokes. She's always like, all the jokes where you accidentally sleep with somebody else. Tell all of those in one set if you could, but it is so let's start at the beginning
starting at the beginning, like, where are you originally? So I'm a Tokyo born person, but where are you from?
Ooh, what if I say I'm not born in Tokyo?
Oh, that'll be cool. Because my brother is not born in Tokyo, so.
Ah.
Yeah.
Me neither.
I have a very eclectic background where my dad had an international business. So even though I'm 100% Japanese, actually I'm lying because I did, in fact, get white culture envy at one point and try 24 on me just to see if dating white guys and eating a lot of Thanksgiving turkey and Oreo cookies may have just on the slight one chance altered my DNA. I took one of those 23andMe thinking, it would make me more interesting than 100% Japanese. And so I did spit into that little valve. 2 weeks later, I got the shortest little two sentences. That did not do justice because All of you guys are like a dream European vacation. It's like I'm 14% French, 20% Italian, 32% Spanish, and you have this wonderful ultimate dream vacation. It came back saying you are 94% Japanese.
Wow.
Ooh, the 6% is, well, actually, what was I going to say? Korean. So I'm slightly Korean, but pretty much all Japanese, and that was that. Born in Anchorage, Alaska.
Oh, that's interesting. That no, I did not have that on the bingo card.
I knew she was born in the United States.
Yeah,
but I don't remember any of it because our family moved like every 3-4 years.
So typical anchor baby.
Yeah, my Japanese family, my sister and my brother were born in Japan. My whole family, 100% Japanese. They were in Alaska for a few years, and I was born the last year. And then when I was 1 year old, we went back to Japan and grew up in Yokohama.
So that's kind of like my brother's story. So I'm a middle of three brothers. My older brother and I born in Tokyo.
Okay.
My young, and then we moved to Japan. And then when I was like, I moved from Japan to New York. I'm sorry, New York.
Okay.
And when I was in New York, my younger brother was born, and then we went back to Japan.
Oh, so I'm like your youngest. Oh,
yeah.
You're the youngest of the three.
Yeah.
So. Nice. So, but I don't remember a word of English because I was a 1 year old baby that went. So my first language is Japanese. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I speak English with accent. So every sentence ends with a question because in Japan, our culture is that we are second class citizens. So we always ask for validation from our male opposite gender to validate our statements.
Yeah, so, it's horrible. I remember working on a TV related stuff where the assistant director, the person second in command, right? She had to pour the tea to all the people,
exactly.
Right? It's like this is so dumb. It's like, you know, you're like number two in charge here.
This is in Japan.
No, well, it was the Japanese crew in Honolulu. I was doing some work in Honolulu. You know, they had some remote, you know, work. It's like, this is dumb, you know.
Yeah, I know. And so this, you know, I tried to get on as many podcasts as possible before a trip to Japan, because this is as much talking I get to do before I go to Japan, where not only is silence a virtue, but I do have an older brother who likes to keep me at like a Hello Kitty level of communication. So after about 3 questions at a 2-hour lunch, he'll literally look at me and be like, "Oi, omae, chotto shaberisugiru." To all the listeners out there.
So annoying.
Jacques, don't laugh at that. You didn't know what she said.
Yeah, it just means that Jack Lambert's hair is just so magnificent. But if only listeners could smell how good his hair is.
Yeah, but you know, she's talking about his nose.
Yeah. So I will ask you because Biff has not given me like a clear answer on this. Is it cultural appropriation that I have a Hello Kitty tattoo on my left thigh?
Are you serious?
I have a whole bit about it. I have, and I will post it when I post this. When I went to Universal last time, and he was mortified. My son was 12, giant Hello Kitty outside of the Sephora store, and take a picture with it with my shorts pulled up to show the tattoo, and then the person in the Hello Kitty costume is making the heart sign. Yeah, my wife had one, and the long story short is she, and I have a bit about it where she said, "I have tattoos I got with or for victims before her, so I must have loved them more. So to prove my undying love, I got a matching tattoo," because she has a Hello Kitty on her upper right thigh. I got the exact same one on my upper left thigh. That way the kitties can snuggle when we sleep together at night. You know, and then, so I don't know. Is that cultural appropriation?
Wow. And your wife is not Japanese?
Well, so my wife, her dad was from Boston, an Irish guy from Boston, was working and living in Seoul, Korea for 2 years. So mm-hmm. my wife, like my car, was made in Korea. So she, but she, you know, when we got together, you know, and she moved from Boston to LA, people were, Bifty, you ever see our Hello Kitty bathroom though, and Marina Del Rey? When I say name an item, whether it's a toothbrush holder, the soap holder, the dispenser, the shower, it was all, and people would come over because we had one bathroom, like, dude.
It was a Hello Kitty bathroom.
She lived for it. Yeah.
Wow. The thing is, though, you know, I didn't want to tell you guys this. Is that you guys are like, you know, you guys are kind of low level if you want to talk about Hello Kitty obsessions from people in my homeland, because, yeah, you got some nice stuff, but yeah, the amount of Hello Kitty stuff. Have you been to any of the Hello Kitty stores while you were back? Yeah. Because like, you know, I walked by, I took my son through it, so I have my son this time around. So I said, you should check this out because this is insane. And you know, it's like all these. Is this necessary? Is it necessary to have Hello Kitty on this item? So many of those.
Wow.
Well, her wedding ring is a custom made Hello Kitty ring, so I'll post that. You know, the second one, because the first one got lost in a carriage ride in New York. But anyways. So, yes.
So I do want to ask, so you were in Yokohama.
Yes.
And is that, how long were you there? Were you there
when I was 8 years old, we moved to Seattle.
Okay.
For a few years. And then when I was 12, we moved back to Japan, Tokyo for eight months. My dad got hired by the government to go on a super amazing mission that I'm super proud to say he succeeded, was that he's a lawyer, international lawyer, and he was hired by the government to work on an international foreign treaty between United States and Japan about the 200-mile rate coastal line fishing rights between it was some sort of a regulation that was not in favor of Japan. Mm. So the Japanese government hired my dad to go to Washington, D.C. to work on this case for like 5 years. And he brought it up to the Supreme Court level and reversed the foreign treaty in favor of Japan. So I'm very proud.
Wow, that is amazing.
Yeah. So that basically explains why I had to go to seventh grade in three different schools in Seattle, Tokyo, and Washington, D.C. And I never got out of seventh grade hell.
So you went to the seventh grade in three different places, where I went to the seventh grade three times, but in the same place. it's a lot. It's exactly the same, but completely different.
So did your parents make you do Saturday school?
Yep.
Oh my God.
Nihongo gakko. Did you go to Nihongo gakko?
Like, I did.
Until what year?
Well, so I had to go until Chusan, right? So and then after that, they didn't have anything.
Until Chuni.
Oh, okay.
You have like 1 year longer Japanese education.
Yeah, but I'm sure like I've forgotten everything. So, but my younger brother was able to, like, I had a little bit of bitterness.
He got out early.
My dad let him quit in his last year so he could play baseball. But you know.
Oh my God! Now where was this?
I was in I went from Tokyo and at age seven. So I was in New York from age two to age five. Age five. To age seven in Tokyo, and from age seven to age 12 I was in Toronto, so I went to Nihongo Gakko there, and then
you had a dad whose occupation like got him around.
Yeah, my dad had a lot of the international branches of the, he worked for the, you know, the whole Cebu, you know, that corporation.
That's a great company.
It's a big company.
Yeah.
What was funny was that the one of the times when I went back to Japan, I wake up in the morning, I turn on the TV, you know, and I'm one of the few people that actually make coffee in Tokyo, but I was making coffee in my hotel room. I turn on the news and I see that, you know, the chairman on the news, and say, what's going on? And it's a securities fraud. What? So I don't know if you know if you follow the Japanese news too much, but the chair of this guy named Tsutsumi Yoshiaki was busted for essentially keeping shell companies and having control of, you know, having more than majority control of his company while his his stock was, on the market.
And this is related to Cebu.
The Cebu company. They have a bunch of stuff, right? They have three hotels. And so I was in his hotel watching him, basically the news telling him that he's getting investigated. This is kind of weird. Yeah.
Oh wow. Well, that's
one of the things on the podcast, and it's one of my favorite things is Biff has the crime story of the week from Japan, and it's always some heinous crime where, well, why don't you describe some of the crimes that you've brought to us?
So do you watch any Japanese like stuff? I watch
Japanese dorama.
Oh, dorama. Oh, do you have
really read the paper.
So one of the things a few years ago, basically in 2016, when things started to get real dark, I stopped watching American news because it's just it's so depressing. So I turn on YouTube, and all the Japanese TV networks have the news, right? Yeah. You watch the Japanese news, and the crime stories in Japanese news is like, some of them are so dumb. Like, they have one of the ones that I brought up was some 70-year-old guy got arrested because he went to 7-Eleven, and in Japan they have the cups that are like, you have to get this, daisho, juice, size, whatever size, right? So you get the cup, and then you have to, if I buy a medium cup, I have to press the medium button, and it doesn't fill it up all the way because you're supposed to fill it up with cream, right? So this guy was pushing the large button, but using only the medium cup.
And he got arrested over that.
The store, guy was watching him.
Oh my god!
And then he called the police.
The news.
Yeah, and the police actually comes and detains him. It's like, come on.
It was also on the Slow Newsday Network, so we have to take that into account.
Yeah.
The fun thing is when Biff finds a story that's like that, one guy was plugging his hot plate into the outlet in the parking lot at a 7-Eleven, and they do reenactments with actors, and they do reenactments with like 3D modeling and stuff. And you literally, you would think this is, it's awesome. Biff always finds it the best.
Yeah. Does 7-Eleven sponsor the news in Japan? Because those are two 7-Eleven stories.
Actually, the first one was a Family Mart. So it's first one was a Famima incident, and the second one is a 7-Eleven incident.
Got you. Okay.
Yeah, it's
so different. It's a big convenience store.
They're competing. They're competing interests. Vying for people's attention. Yeah.
So let's get into the comedy aspect. So when did you take all this world travel, all these experiences, and say, I have this background.
But your core thing is, your classical play is elite level, right? So
hey, who's that?
You. Because I watch your Carnegie Hall,
You're talking. You're gonna have to say names because there are four of us in case people.
Only one person is classically trained. Right.
So Sarah.
Podcast.
Okay, I don't know.
Sarah. Yeah. So I guess I do want to kind of find out, like, you have a pretty hardcore, music background, right? So can you kind of tell us about that? And then maybe we could switch from there to see, how does that go to comedy, right?
Perfect.
Oh, absolutely. It's plain and clear. It's, that 85% of the classical musicians in the world today are Asian females. And now give us a mic and ask us at any one point if this is what we want to do and if this is our passion. And all you have to do is just, you're asking the wrong person. You just have to give the mic to her tiger mom. Yes. And ask her, is this... So every Asian mom's dream is to become a concert pianist, but they never made it. So they force their Asian daughters to learn piano or violin. Wow. Usually piano's top number one, because they can really show off their red dress against the black glorious looking. I mean, it's all shallow. It's like all the Asian moms out there on the planet have daughters that they cultivate into a classical musician. So the point is, I never chose to play the piano. So it was something that I was already doing. I guess I was pretty good at it. So studying with the best teachers in the world. at age 12, I was writing a 10-page letter to my parents saying, you know, you could save a lot of money if you didn't, if you let me stop taking piano lessons. That didn't work.
That
my
didn't
mom
work.
Just looked at me, didn't even speak a word. She read the letter. She made one long, intense eye contact. And then she just like ripped it in half.
Oh, I was going to say, did she burn through the letter with her gaze? With the heat? This is what I think of this letter.
Wow.
That,
I mean,
that's your Hollywood version. Yeah. But seriously, I never had a choice. I guess I was pretty good.
Clearly.
Yeah. And at one point, I mean, I made friends with the enemy, meaning like now I love it. Like I love the music and the classical music, and Carnegie Hall was fun.
Yeah.
Joe, how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
I think you take 95 South.
You're like lying, 80? George. You're lying.
Oh, practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean.
So basically, it's very traumatic, meaning classical music can be very traumatic because, first of all, we are already doing this thing that our parents want us to do with no say. And a lot of us hate it because it's just like 3-4 hours of practice every day, which means no social life, no nothing. And you don't have a life. This is all you do. And you're miserable. And also, I don't know if you guys noticed, but classical musicians are generally, you know, very serious people because we have an overwhelming amount of information and notes that we have to learn. So some of us, I think, just end up being just so serious all the time. And generally amongst my classical music colleagues, people just don't laugh. People don't really joke about everything because it's all serious all the time. And so part of it is that I'm trying to balance all of that seriousness with comedy. And to also, as a composer, to point out the fact that the music that we're playing is not always uptight and serious. Like Beethoven, Haydn, all these people had a sense of humor. But believe it or not, classical musicians don't believe the music is funny. It's really true. They don't believe that humor does not belong in the classical music scene. And so I'm a bit of a rebel and trying to balance that out by now I'm teaching a new class at NAC called Let's Improv Classical, where we're going to be doing a, by the way, this is a little bit of a announcement, but on May 11th, we're going to have a big first groundbreaking show that combines theater, humor, comedy, and improvisation in the classical music style.
Oh.
But this is considered very groundbreaking because comedy in classical music is really not something that has been happening for most of, but recently it's kind of coming out with like Victor Borga, and I think there are, you know, a couple musicians out there making podcasts with humor and classical music, but it's a new thing.
I will disagree with you in one point that there was no classical music and comedy mixture, because as a child of the 80s, I grew up watching Tom and Jerry and Bugs Bunny cartoons, and there was a lot of introduction of, there were concertos where, you know, Tom would be at the piano and Jerry would be trying to screw him up by, you know, meddling with the hammers on inside the piano. And of course, that in and of itself was traumatic for both Tom and Jerry. So, that's...
But classical musicians like my colleagues and I would not consider the use of classical music in cartoons as legit. Mm-hmm. We would just look at that as just like an unfortunate accident, and we wouldn't consider that.
Like all the musicians see their work was used in a cartoon and they're horrified, right?
That's my introduction to classical music is Bugs Bunny cartoons. And it's funny how much I know because it's got used in different Leopold. But circling back to like the Tiger Mom thing. So that's a real thing. And it spills into other cultures, because myself, I didn't want to grow up angry with abandonment issues. But when my dad beat me and left when I was 6, I mean, so every parent I just wanted Joe's face. It's like he's not. Yeah, he is. He's doing it again. No. So everybody, is it a commonality where you guys bond together as musicians, having a similar parents who push like this, or is there a lot of competition at that level? Is it more a bonding thing over it, or is it competitive?
No, a competitive, no bonding at all. In fact, being a classical pianist, it is one of the loneliest things you can do because of all the classical musical instruments out there. If you're at least playing an orchestra instrument, which could be the strings or the brass or whatever, you could be part of an orchestra and make friends that way. But one thing we always say is that every non-pianist classical instrument player needs a pianist, because they're a melodic instrument. And when they have to play alone in a recital, they would have to hire a pianist to play the other part. That's the accompanying part. However, we as pianists, we're like the one set of instrumentalists that are self-sufficient. We don't need other instruments to play with us. We're complete. That's why we have the treble clef and the bass clef. And so we don't need other pianists. We don't need other instrumentalists, which means that we could be locked in a room practicing 8 hours a day. And maybe if you become as famous as Martha Argerich, all you do is practice 8 hours a day, get on a plane, go to the next town, play a recital for 2 hours. And since classical music fans are not very social, you're not going to be greeting anyone. So you're going to be going, living a life of a lonely touring concert pianist that practices by themselves, plays recitals by themselves, literally like just a super lonely life of
a traveling sideshow, but just like you're in one exhibit. Just like, okay, now time to wheel the exhibit off the stage and onto the plane, onto the next venue.
Yeah, it's extremely lonely being a pianist. And that's one of the reasons I think, comedy and jazz and the other things I do is partly because trying to, fill back the emptiness where I was pretty much just always alone, just go to school, practice the piano, go to school, practice the piano. That was it. So kind of trying to catch up with life.
Well, and when did the acting start?
Well, actually, interestingly, my mom was a very theatrical person. So when she went to college in Japan, she was doing a lot of theater, and she was always playing the lead, very theatrical woman. And by the way, I wanna put a footnote to the my comment about tiger moms.
Yeah.
My mom, I would say tiger moms exist everywhere in the classical music and Asian culture. My mom was very willful about me playing the piano, but she was very relaxed about the rest of my life. Like, she was never pushing me to do homework or pressure me to get straight A's. I mean, I did that on my own. She was very relaxed about it. She just cared about my health and sleeping and practicing. But so she wasn't quite the complete tiger mom that I see everywhere, where they're really pushy about academics and activities. So I'll say that. But my mom was very theatrical. I guess I acted in a play in Japan in seventh grade. I was part of the Showstoppers in high school in America. I would say becoming a musician, the way I approached it is that I would try to channel the composer that I'm playing, like whether it's Beethoven or Chopin. And I found that as I absorbed the culture of these composers, the European culture, I speak Italian, French, German, that you start learning how to shift your energy around. So the more I developed my repertoire as a musician, I felt like I could slip into these characters, like a Beethoven character or, Rachmaninoff. And then I have a lot of actor friends, and they were like, Sarah, you should do acting. And then I took like a free acting workshop, and my friends were all encouraging me like, Sarah, you're a natural. You really need to set up your acting, profile. And then I think gradually over the past 15 years or so, I started doing theater, live theater, movies, TV commercials, a little bit, just a little bit.
And when do you sleep?
The answer is I don't have kids. And I retired from dating. So that leaves me with lots and lots of time, because all that time I was creating fake accounts, stalking my boyfriend, reading all of his texts, and having to, you know, follow his car everywhere. That you know, now is living, giving me back like 5 hours every day.
Yeah. I retired from dating too, 22 years ago when I got married. Yeah. So, you know,
there you go.
Haven't been on a date since.
No. So I think not dating and not having children and not having a family. Yeah. Yeah. That'll give you back a lot of time.
And you feel lonely somehow.
Yeah, I am very, actually, I'm still very lonely, but. Oh.
Well, you're welcome here. We can do a weekly podcast if you'd like.
Seriously. Okay.
Gentlemen, no, I have a lot of time.
By the way, Biff and Joe, are you guys on the Pacific coast today or who?
No,
just me.
I'm actually about an hour from now, I'll be going to Berkeley. And I'm not kidding.
Oh, so
because
you're in Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Biff, you're in.
I'm in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that's why. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Go ahead, Joe.
I was going to say do the music thing again. So Berklee School of Music is where I'm going to be taking my son in about an hour. No, my son does vocal lessons on Saturdays.
Oh, nice.
But I also wanted to clarify, when you said you teach at NEC, a lot of people might not know that NEC is New England Conservatory of Music. Yeah. So yeah, that's, you know, for our not, for the troglodytes out there who don't know what NEC stands for.
By the way, because I didn't do my work, are all of us comedians in here?
I am not.
Okay,
I am not.
Joe says he's not. I met Joe in 94 and we started to do a sketch comedy show together. I moved to LA in 95. Joe moved out a couple years later for a little while, and we've been writing comedy together since 94. We've written a bunch of stuff. Biff and I started playing hockey together around 95-96. Yeah. And so that's how Biff and I know each other. And then I moved back here. My wife took a job and we moved to Qatar in 2014. And then her mom got sick, so we moved back here in 2017. So I'm in Boston because to take care of my mom-in-law. And then the pandemic sidetracked us. Joe says he's not a comedian or comedy. And I say this all the time, and Biff knows it's true. Yep. If I do a 10-minute set and get 20 laughs, like, 10 of the chuckles are mine, but the real belly laughs, the ones where people come up and say, oh, that line, it's something that Joe wrote.
You are still continuing to write together?
I considered myself retired from comedy, but you know.
so you were a stand-up comedian at one point? Or?
18 years, when I was 18 years old, so about 30 years ago.
Okay.
So in
you did that for how long?
About a year. And okay. But I also started a family young, and then, that kind of sidetracked me from other stuff, so.
But Jack and Joe, you write together.
We should, yeah. Well, reluctantly, he writes with me because I call him and say, here's my new bit, and he says, yeah, that's okay, change this, and that change is what makes it funny.
Well, you come up with a premise, and then I insert a joke.
and that's what works. So he does that. And the other cool thing is when we moved back here, when my wife, got pregnant with our first kid, she's a nanny. Her nanny job has traveled us around the world 10 times and back. And so I knew nothing about kids. All I said is, I wasn't going to push hockey on them or anything like that. I just want them to be vegetarian until they're old enough to make their own decisions about things. And secondly, I wanted them to start playing piano and do jiu-jitsu.
So they do play piano. Yeah.
And not a Tiger Mom thing, like one lesson a week for a half hour and then practice 15, just because I wanted them to understand that music is a language. I'm dyslexic. I couldn't read till I was 16. Yeah. So I can't help with that stuff, but I wanted them to have this world because, and then when we moved back here, Joe's son, who has been, when Joe's son was six, his oldest son was six, he was writing parodies of Weird Al songs. And so his son was my son's piano teacher until my boys got proficient enough in jiu-jitsu where they could keep me from making them do piano. But for the first 3 years, we moved back here. And when Joe and I started the podcast, I would go over to Joe's house. Yeah. We go down into his man cave surrounded by every video game you can imagine. And my boys would be upstairs with his oldest son getting their weekly piano lesson.
That's so sweet.
It is. It was really nice.
But back to Sarah, because, you know, time's a ticking.
So, yeah. So when did the comedy start? When did you say, this isn't enough, I need to do this?
Well, first of all, by the way, I just want to thank you guys for putting me on the show today, because I know, just Jack, we went back and forth so many times, and I'm sorry, like, I just had so much going on in the past few months, so we couldn't quite nail down a date. And I think today I'm coming in after like just a 3-day messaging. So I just want to say, first of all, thank you for opening it up for me. So thank you. So this is what I'm going to say. I'll try to make it as short as possible. My brother has been a big influence in my life. He's 6 years older than me, and he's the one who plays jazz trumpet and was the funny one in the family. Oh. And when I was growing up in Japan, my brother would basically imitate a lot of the comedians on Japanese TV. And as the youngest in the family that just really wanted my brother's affection, I would just imitate whatever he did. So I think physical comedy, which was popular at the time, was happening in Japan. So I started with Japanese comedians that my brother was imitating. And I would start doing that since I was a little girl. And I think I soon realized that whatever my brother likes is important to me, just to be liked. So I think that's how subconsciously I started liking jazz and comedy since I was a little girl, because that's what my brother did. So that was already like happening. And then whatever cartoons he liked, like I think he liked The Wild Side, like, you know, all these cool, whatever my brother. So, and then, so that was already happening. And then let's see, I think it started with me discovering Victor Borge. Borge is a pianist who's known as like a first-rate world-class pianist and comedian. So I ended up buying all of his DVDs and watching all of it. And then it turns out, like, when I would do piano concerts, I just naturally wanted to put some humor into whatever I did. And so my piano concerts became like a piano shows with comedy theater and piano playing. And then at one point I was playing these recitals and I met a professional clown who literally went to a clown college and toured with the Russian circus named Marty Levin. He's a fantastic clown. He came to one of my shows and he came up to me and said, Sarah, you're a natural clown. You need to work with me and perform with me. And I said, I'm not. I didn't believe I was a clown, but I said, I'm happy to play some music for you when you perform. But at the last minute, he pushed me onto the stage and said, you are going to do improv clowning with me today. And he just put me on the spot. And there's a really wonderful YouTube video that I'm very proud of where he and I did sketch clowning comedy. Then I'm really proud to say that was improvised. And I think I was surprised to watch it later and realize how funny it was. And he was like, you just made your debut as a clown. So I did some clowning. So that's physical comedy because that was no talking. So I was doing Victor Borge. I was doing my own humor at piano recitals at least 20 years back. My brother, and then the clowning. And then I started becoming part of an independent theater group called the Energy Theater Group for like 8 years, where you could create whatever you wanted. So I started creating sketch comedy with a friend of mine. I did stand-up comedy, sketch comedy. And then the director was writing comedy. So I would perform his comedic scenes. And then I became the detective and dinner detective, which is kind of like a comedy infused dinner theater. So I did that for a while. And then my passion was improv comedy. So I went to Improv Boston for like a year and a half and took all the classes, which was right before the pandemic. And I was ready to audition to become part of the cast, like the improv theater. Right. That was my dream. But never at any one point in my entire life did I ever want to be a stand-up comedian. Never.
I too also took courses at Improv Boston back in 99.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. So my love was improv comedy because I would go to their shows and be mesmerized. I was like, oh my God, this is what I want to do. So I was ready to audition to become part of the cast when the pandemic hit and the entire school closed down. Oh, wait, but before it closed down, one of the staff members who teaches at IB and I were having tea and we were talking about our life stories. And at one point he's like, Sarah, you really should take a stand-up comedy class because you've got some good material for it. And so I think literally 6 months before the pandemic, I took a stand-up comedy class with Dan Crone. Still didn't like it because I was just looking for socialization, I guess. The lonely pianist in me didn't want to be alone. I wanted to be part of a team and playing. And stand-up felt like work because you had to be by yourself, go home, be self-sufficient, like the lonely pianist that I was, because a stand-up comedian is an independent, self-sufficient comedy artist, whereas the improv comedian would be part of a group. And I think I so wanted to be part of a group and interact with other people. Stand-up comedy to me felt like exactly like being a pianist, which is going home, doing the work, and then practicing by yourself, standing by yourself. And it's still, so even now, like part of me is like, oh, it just feels more like practicing piano, which is like you're by yourself, you're writing the material, you go up by yourself. So it's something that grew on me. And the only reason I started stand-up comedy was because there was no other alternative to comedy. I couldn't do improv. So I basically started doing it because I was locked down, quarantined alone. So I don't live with anyone. I don't have a family. And I felt like going to a mic was the only way I would be part of any sort of a comedy scene. So that's how I started basically during the pandemic. And so that's kind of what's going on.
Yeah.
Hope that didn't take up the whole show.
Oh, no. But that's,
we want to hear you. We hear enough from you.
Okay. I was like, I'm talking too much.
No.
This is like a year's worth of talking if I were to go back to Japan.
By the way, did you have HBO as a kid? Because that's where I found Victor Borga.
No,
okay.
I never had cable. I just watched YouTube videos.
Yeah. I had Victor Borga on Sesame Street.
Yeah. He was on PBS. Like he was on PBS. Like PBS in Boston was always great. And if it was, you know, I mean, everybody talks about like there was only three networks growing up. There wasn't, because I watched PBS as much as because it had like Monty Python. It had, but it would have, and there's also a political pianist.
Mark Russell.
There was always a Mark Russell special on, you like PBS, like, you know, comedy and piano with him. And I love politics. I was political junkie growing up. So that's where I've heard of Victor Borga. I'm not saying it right. I'm sorry.
Borga.
And then, of course, the commercials for the guy who was the master, Sanfier, the master of the pan flute. Like the my classical, like, you know, introduction was
Bugs Bunny. Tom Lehrer was also like a comedy pianist, you know.
Yeah.
He wrote a lot of funny songs. Tom Lehrer.
Okay. There's also PDQ Bach. I don't know.
Oh, yes.
Great. So I just love all of that.
And comedy.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say comedy is mostly a solo thing unless you're really, really obnoxious with your friends like Joe or Biff or and then there's some other people. Like over the pandemic, I ended up like roping Joe and like four or five of my friends saying, hey, we're gonna get together once a week and punch up each other's material. And that was so much fun. That was literally so much fun to kind of have this collaborative, you know, type thing. But it is. It's 90% plus, you know. But last week I made Joe like I had a kind of a big show and I made him drive the hour with me and back. Is like, you know,
where was it?
It was just up in Portsmouth. There's a comic, Jim McHugh, who's the best. So he, for some reason, has given me like four or five hosting opening things.
That's awesome.
But my first one, I kind of needed my safety blanket, Joe, to drive with me. So it can be a lonely thing. So when you think of yourself, are you a pianist, an actress, a comedian, or is it all equally love at this point?
I don't know. I'm totally confused. I think so. As you can tell from my middle name, I'm basically like I'm actually a really spiritual person. So the infinity is kind of a concept that I'm striving for in my life as a way to understand humanity. So the reason I'm doing jazz and classical and comedy, part of it is to really expand my consciousness so I can really be in the shoes of everyone else, understand. So I guess part of me is coming from the perspective of bringing peace to the world through being a bridge between different ways of thinking and being. I come from two generations of Christian ministers. And ever since I was a little girl, I was like, how can I bring peace to the world? And it started with like the idea of bringing understanding within myself. So part of it is acting, especially, you know, you put yourself in the mind of other people.
It's funny. You said understanding reason. Biff and I have a friend whose son's name is that Masanori or Toshiashi? Which one means understanding reason?
Understanding reason.
Because we have another friend who plays hockey with us, whose wife's from Japan, and they have the most Japanese first name and the most Canadian American last name, which is so. I want to ask you this question. So, what it's interesting. Did you see the animated movie Soul that came out a couple years ago about the jazz pianist?
I only watched the Japanese movie about a jazz saxophone player.
So it won the Academy Award for music. It was great. But one of the really interesting things is he was a great pianist, but life got in the way and he became a piano teacher at a middle school and he finally gets a chance older. When he's playing piano, his soul leaves his body.
Oh, wow.
And the whole story is his soul kind of got stuck in another dimension. He's trying to get back. But I ask you that because that's why I was asking what you see yourself. Mm-hmm. Of all the great things I've got to do, when I saw that movie Soul, it was like 2 years ago. So my kids were like 13 and 10. And that's the first time that I saw what I feel like sometimes. I play with the same band, you know, and since college. And when my guitarist and I are jamming, there are some times where I'm not there. It is just so, and at the same time, and Biff might get this with hockey, there are some, it happens now and then, and it's something out of a movie where everything slows in the middle of a play, and you see.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like a psychedelic experience. Yeah. I've had that.
And when I do comedy, I've never felt that. I've always been there. I've always been present in the moment, and I love doing it. Like the addiction of getting a laugh, I heard is great. Maybe I'll get some someday. But when I'm playing drums with my buddy Dan, and we're not doing an old song, we're not working on a song, we're just jamming.
Yeah.
And you hit this. And when I saw the guy's body leave when he was playing because he was that euphoric, and that's why I asked. So as much as now I'm a comedian, I've always loved comedy. If I can do one thing the rest of my life, if heaven is this for you, it would either be playing hockey with the greatest of the greats that I grew up loving from different I wouldn't want to play in a band with a great musicians and the people. I would just want to play with my buddy Dan because I've not had that feeling any other time. So even though right now I do comedy is my thing, I wanted that. So that's how I feel. So do you get those feelings when you do comedy, when you act, when you play piano? Do you ever you're not there? You're just enjoying it so much that you're just kind of free form.
Well, I what I would say is that, first of all, life is a balance. Like, I don't think it's just like eating ice cream or your favorite meal every day. That would be boring. Yeah. So for me, I get bored very easily. So like going in and out of these.
Yeah, you can't tell that to Jacques. He eats he eats French fries every day.
I was going to say, Jacques, you're not supposed to eat the ice cream every day.
Now you tell me.
And by the way, sometimes my soul leaves my body when I do this podcast, but I think that's a different thing.
You have to go. That's funny. Oh man. Well, thank you. I think for me, it's the variety. The infinity is how is my, but I would say because I have the most training in piano, like I had the highest level experiences in piano, and my comedy and the rest of the things that I do is not the same level that I would consider how where I play the piano, whatnot. So I guess striving to get better and better at everything I do is something that
You
motivates me.
and it's not, would you ever, I don't know, maybe this is like two worlds colliding, would you ever incorporate your piano into your stand-up?
No.
Okay, yeah, just making sure.
I would not say never, but like right now the idea is the comedy scene is where I go get a break from the classical scene. And but I have already incorporated comedy into my piano shows, and that will be happening at the May. But bringing classical piano to my sacred comedy scene would,
So, so that we can let you go enjoy the rest of your day. May
no.
11th is where you have the big thing come, and it's open
Black
to
Box Theater. It's open to the public at the. It's going to be at the Black Box Theater, May 11th, Saturday evening. This is my kids' show. It's not me performing, but it's the kids that I train
That's
will be
great.
performing a
That's
show.
awesome.
So, so
And
that.
where can people follow? Where's the best place to follow you
I have
for?
no idea. I'm all over the place. I think it's just my name. If you Google Sarah
Yeah.
Infant Takagi, it'll show up.
So it's the same. It's the same on Instagram. It is. It is Facebook
Yeah.
and TikTok and stuff. No.
And YouTube.
And YouTube. Thank you. Yeah. I'm going to. The first thing
Or
that I want to
just
do.
call Biff's great great grandmother's
And she will. Okay.
uncle's
Yeah.
nephew who has all the diary.
And your
Well,
web.
I don't know
Oh.
if you know this, but you know that 6% Korean is actually Jock's wife's,
There you go.
uncle's grandfather's.
So I'd like to thank my cousin Infinity for being on the show today.
Thank you so much, guys, for having me. I didn't know what to expect, but this was so much fun.
And I just
Thank
want to add that
you.
I learned a lot about your background really quickly from your website, sarahinfinitytakagi.com.
There.
And yeah, it's, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced any of those names because, I too am a bland white person who can't say
Okay,
certain.
by the way, can you guys like Instagram connect me or so, or
Yes,
Yeah, yeah.
100%.
Because
But
I would love to keep in touch with you, Joe and Biff, but I don't know how to find you. So can you message me
Sure.
or
Absolutely.
something?
Hey
That'd be
Biff,
great.
I'm gonna let you wrap the show
Yep.
up, Biff. And why did you
You're gonna
feel
let me.
comfortable and do it in your native tongue? Why don't you
Yeah,
guys end it?
only I will know.
Work up your
No,
best five insults towards me and Jock and
I mean, well, I mean, my Japanese is so horrible, but my
Arigato
ありがとうございました。楽しい1時間を。
gozaimasu. Arigato. Tanoshikatta. また、じゃあ、
こ
メッ
ちらこ
セー
そ。
ジしてください。
Yes, I'm, obviously a fantastic hour. So much to talk about, so much, I mean, I think, if we could ever get you
Message me.
back, we'd love to see hear about, more about a lot of the experiences you had, because that's quite a bit that we crammed into an hour, so.
Yeah, thank you guys. This was so much fun.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank
Oh,
you.
and
Yeah, thank
Biff,
you, Joe.
thank you.
Don't forget.